Hey everyone, it's Cam Hurt, host of the Best Show Ever podcast, and we have got a second season coming out very soon that I am very excited about. We've got some very cool special guests, including musical acts that we all love, like Karina Reichman, Daniel Donato, Jake Brownstein from Eggy, Rick and Peter from Goose, and many more. Tune in for new episodes dropping on Osiris Media March 5th on the Best Show Ever podcast.
Hi, listeners. I want to tell you about a cause that I'm involved with at Heritage Radio Network. HRN is celebrating its 15th year, and to celebrate, we're deepening our commitment to giving voice to the next generation of food system storytellers, and we need your help. Our internship and fellowship programs help activate new possibilities for underrepresented and underestimated young people through experiential journalism, audio engineering, and production training. Through these unique programs, HRN helps food equity stewards build essential workforce readiness skills that expand their potential and foster economic mobility. Please consider supporting these critical programs. And with a minimum donation, you can be entered to win a dinner for two at an amazing restaurant in one of eight cities and tickets to a concert at a great venue in one of those cities. We have incredible partners across the country who have donated, as they also share our passion for helping to educate the next generation of food system storytellers. Check out heritageradionetwork.org/15 to donate and enter to win today. That's heritageradionetwork.org/15 to donate and enter to win today. And make sure you donate before March 31st. Thank you.
Osiris.
Hello, old friends. I'm Brian Brinkman.
I'm David Goldstein. The date is February 21st. 2022, happy President's Day. You can celebrate the presidents of America while listening to The Drop.
And let's be clear, we're not celebrating all the presidents, okay?
No.
Like, I'm not celebrating Harden. I'm just not celebrating Harden. Just not going to do it. Can't do it. I can't celebrate McKinley. I just can't do it.
The thing is, he wasn't around very long. There's no fault of his own, McKinley.
McKinley?
Yeah.
No, but like, the entire idea of American exceptionalism and like on the foreign front can be driven back to McKinley. And the dude never deserved a mountain. Let's be real.
No.
Like the dude never deserved a mountain. Harding, I can't support.
You can support Harding as being the last president not to have a college degree.
This is true.
There's some history. Yeah. Fond of having trysts in the White House closets, Warren G. Harding did.
And let's be clear, neither one of us are celebrating Mr. Milhouse Nixon.
No, certainly not celebrating Richard Nixon, no.
I'm still reading that book about him, and the deeper I get into the book, I'm just like, you conniving, backstabbing little weasel. Like, how did that guy emerge from the 1960s? It really showcases to you this like deep underbelly of conservatism in America that will never go away.
He had the war on cancer and he opened up China. Those are his two somewhat achievements, if you're going to give him any credit.
The EPA, you got to give a man some credit for the EPA. But let's just like be real. The entire Republican Party is in Nixon's image at this point in time.
Mm.
But the rest of them, most of the rest of them, let's give a big shout out to some of the presidents. And I'll give a shout out before we get into the meat of this episode here. the Mr. Beat YouTube account. If you ever want some like easy presidential history that feels like you've stepped back into the best sophomore year, current events, constitutional law, American history type classes that we all had to take, and some of us consumed more than others. I loved those classes. The Mr. Beat YouTube account, he is a college professor who he ranks his favorite presidents. He ranks the ways that presidents died. He ranks their favorite food. He goes through an entire history of the presidents in one YouTube sitting. It's like one massive 4-hour him just talking from Washington all the way to Trump. It's really amazing stuff. He's a great...
If you know, I'm curious. I have to check this out. But what was the top 5 or the top 3 for like how the presidents died? And what was the criteria for that?
I'm blanking on it right now, but I think that the top ones who died were all those that died in stunning assassinations because it was the most just like extreme way to die. So I think Lincoln was number 1 in the sense that like there's no way to go out bigger as a president than Abraham Lincoln, who like the Emancipation Proclamation, you work to end the Civil War. And then that's it. That's your legacy. There's no scandal beyond that. There's no second term lame duck aspect. It's just like you go out in a fit of gunfire and then it's over. But anyway, yes, it is President's Day. It's also in keeping with the theme of big sporting events. The NBA All-Star Game just happened last night. We are recording in advance of it, so I don't even know who won the slam dunk contest. But I will say, for any listeners out there, if you didn't watch the All-Star Game, and if you don't intend to watch All-Star Games in the future, which I get, I have no interest in watching the Pro Bowl. I watch the Baseball All-Star Game, and I watch the Basketball All-Star Game. The Basketball All-Star Game has reformatted its gameplay in the last 2 years, and it is absolutely incredible. Every single quarter resets to 0 in terms of the score, and then they take the difference between where the two teams are at the end of the third quarter, and they say, okay, here's the score now. Let's say both teams have, or the West has 127, the East has 115. The final score is based on a formula that they have to play to that final score. So if the final score is like 158, they play until one team hits 158. So if the East comes storming back and they catch the West, there's no clock, there's no timeouts. It's just you play until you hit that final score. And it is some of the best basketball you could ever watch because like these dudes actually put everything into it. So I can't wait to watch that, and I hope that it was as great of a game as the 2020 version was.
I hope that Obi Toppin won the slam dunk contest because Knicks fans don't have very much to be happy about at this point in time, other than the fact that we're pretty much guaranteed to see fish at night as opposed to 3 o'clock in the afternoon.
This is true. Aside from Michael Jordan, I would never want to root for any one of my players to be in the slam dunk contest.
Yeah, well, what's the reason being? Just not flashy enough or don't want them to get hurt or...
I more or less don't want them to get hurt. And I also find that you get a type of player, Zach LaVine, Aaron Gordon, a style of player that wins the slam dunk contest and then Dwight Howard, Vince Carter, and that becomes their entire persona going forward. And it takes away from the raw basketball talent that someone could have and makes them just like every time they got the ball, they got to go up for a big slam because however many people in the crowd know that that's the slam dunk champ.
Didn't Nate Robinson win the slam dunk contest once despite being like 5'10"?
Yeah, I think it's sometime in the mid-aughts right. He won, and it was pretty impressive when it happened.
Yeah, he was a Knick. I guess he was liked on the Knicks. He was kind of had very me-first mentality.
He played for the Bulls in 2013, okay. Which is my second favorite Bulls team ever. But it was definitely post-Knicks when he had probably played at that point on 15 NBA teams, something crazy like that. And like, he was just getting a shot, and the Bulls just needed a guy who they could plug into the Derrick Rose role and just go. So he was beloved, but he was also, yeah, he was very much of a me first guy. He played for the Knicks during that era when cities that have high Irish populations would wear green jerseys on St. Patrick's Day. And so it was like the Bulls, the Celtics, of course, the Knicks, the Nets. I feel like the 76ers did it. It was like all these old world American cities that have high Irish populations. And the Knicks, with like the green and orange and blue, it just never looked right.
Yeah, no, that would not work at all for the Knicks. I know sometimes they try to sell like the green New York Mets jerseys that I think I used to see like Nas, the rapper from Queens, would wear his like green Mets jersey in like some music videos, but he was the only person who could make it look awesome.
What's happening though with your Knicks right now? You said that you guys are flailing. Has it hit rock bottom, or are we on our way there?
It could be close to rock bottom. Their latest thing is fucking up 20-point leads in the fourth quarter.
That's always a fun period for a team.
Play
like
really solid for three quarters, and then Tom Thibodeau's refusal to play the young guys. You got the starters going out incredibly gassed and like they're just running suicide drills. Julius Randle can't play for that long and be effective. So then they drop these 20-point leads. I think they dropped a 28-point lead to the Nets, and then they did that. They dropped one to Thunder, 20-point lead. And then what starts to happen in New York is that people start whispering in the tabloids. You've got, like, World Wide West saying how he blames Tom Thibodeau for the rotations and James Dolan's getting involved. There's always, like, whenever things go downhill for the Knicks, they always start, like, the whisper campaign through the tabloids. That's when things, like, start to go south. So hopefully their only hope is for Derrick Rose to come back guns blazing after the All-Star break, because I don't think they realize how much they miss that guy, because he's basically the only real point guard on the team anymore.
You know, it's interesting with Tibbs, because he's had this issue. He had this issue in Minnesota. I guess he kind of had this issue in Chicago, but the impression I had always was that it was the front office. There are players on the Knicks who played for him in Chicago and still give everything to play for him in New York.
They all say he's not the problem. I think the locker room loves him, but just the array of Knicks bloggers and Jesus and Mero and even Dave Grippo from the Giant Country Horns, the only time he ever goes on Twitter is to like bash his beloved Knicks and Giants. It's just when there's like 800 people on Twitter saying like, Tibbs, what the fuck are you doing? Why is Randall playing like 45 minutes? Like, something's...
Yeah, the rotations are weird. Yeah. I just, I still look back on if he had been given one additional year in Chicago, something could have happened. But Gar Pax, man, fire him. They were fired and still fire him again. I wish that we could keep firing them. The Bulls are in a very interesting position right now where they are number one in the Eastern Conference, having won... the Bulls are tied for number one in the Eastern Conference with the Miami Heat after Miami won last night in Charlotte, or the night before the All-Star break in Charlotte. The Bulls have won five straight, 38-21. It's a pretty amazing place to be for this team. I'm guessing we're going to finish somewhere around 53-54 losses, maybe 52, just depending on how things go in the last couple weeks of the season. But it's a great spot to be in. DeMar DeRozan, dude, like 7 or 8 straight games of 30-plus points. It is, and he hasn't scored a single three in this stretch. It's like my favorite style of basketball ever.
He's been incredible. He's been a pickup that I don't think either he or the Bulls could have anticipated how good he was going to be playing in the year of our Lord 2022.
No, everybody, I mean, it was considered the worst signing of the offseason, and I hated it. It was crazy.
You're seeing a rock show tonight, right? Hopefully.
I'm going to see the War on Drugs here this evening. They're playing in Denver. They're playing at the Mission Ballroom, which is fast becoming my favorite place to see music in Denver, Colorado, at least indoor. And yeah, everything I've heard, they're playing Seeger covers. The show has a loose vibe to it. I'm just stoked, man. It's the War on Drugs. I haven't seen him since October 2017.
Oh, wow.
It's going to be fantastic.
Yeah, like I had said, the show I saw at the Garden back on January 29th was great. I bet they're even looser and more experienced now, having played a whole bunch of shows. I think they've been changing the set list a little bit. They're running some Dylan covers, some Seeger covers. I mean, I think that should be a blast. I'm looking forward to hearing about that.
Yeah, it's you guys can't see me, I'm recording, but I got my black and red checkered flannel that's all ready for the show. I'm just going to be matching Adam. It's just going to be like dad vibes from the stage. I'm curious, like, I may actually count how many flannel shirts I see at the show tonight, because I feel like it's going to be a vibe there.
Yeah, I'd say the show will be over and you'll still be counting the amount of flannel shirts. I was
like a sea of flannel.
I was careful listeners to note in the last podcast that at this point I was supposed to have seen Steve Gunn at Union Pool this past Tuesday night, but that didn't exactly happen, because if you recall, these were free shows, and that you would take an app by this company called Dice, and you would just make a reservation, and then that was going to be your ticket. Except, I think what they did was that they just, anybody who wanted a reservation could get one at any time, irrespective of the capacity of Union Pool. They never cut it off. So I got there, I showed up about 45 minutes before the opening act, which is usually, in rock band parlance, is a pretty safe time to show up to a show and have it be empty. But it was already, quote-unquote, sold out, and that the venue was practically over capacity. People were on top of each other as it was first come, first serve. Normally, it's better practice to cut free things off when they go over capacity. I certainly don't blame Steve Gunn. I think is anyone worth blaming? It was just kind of a shit show. I know our buddy, friend of the pod, Sam Timber, got there and it was sold out, but I think he just had a beer and hung out, and eventually somehow he got in because that's what he does, or someone just gave him a bracelet, or I don't know, but happy for Sam, but I'm too old for that shit.
Sam gets in everywhere. I've seen every Dick show with Sam since 2017. And he and I approach concerts very differently. I have to be in my place. I have to be in like my spot for the show hours before the show begins. Sam just kind of wanders, and at like 8:22, he's like, "All right, I'm gonna go grab a beer and a slice of pizza. You want anything?" And I'll be like, "Dude,
the
show
are you talking
is coming
about?
On.
Like, what are you doing?
The show is starting. Like, it's dark. I like we're ready." And he'll be like, "I'll be back," without question. I don't know how he does it, but he just runs up. He grabs like three beers, carries them back, and three slices of pizza, and comes back. So everybody has a beer for the first set, and everybody has a slice of pizza for the first set, and he makes it back right before the lights drop. It's crazy. It's uncanny.
Not all heroes wear capes. He certainly
not all.
Does not.
No.
So,
shout out
yeah,
to Timber.
I didn't get to see Steve Gunn, but that's okay. What else we got here? There's a new festival coming. This is close to my heart. There's going to be a new festival in Connecticut on my birthday, actually, my birthday weekend this year, September 24th and 25th, called the Sound on Sound Festival, because it is being taken place in Seaside Park in Bridgeport, Connecticut, on Long Island Sound. This is the site where for many years throughout the late, I think early 2000s and early 2010s, they had the Gathering of the Vibes, which was kind of like Peach Fest before Peach Fest. And that it was just a bunch of hippie bands put together in this not very big park in Bridgeport, Connecticut. I went to the edition in, I want to say, 2000. I think the headliner was Rat Dog. I saw Mo. I saw Strange Folk. I saw Les Claypool and his band. And I think Les Claypool just played one bass line for 30 minutes. And he said, like, "I love you jam kids, because I can literally play one bass line for 30 minutes. And you guys will eat it up. Thank you." I think usually the headliner was like Phil and Friends or something with Warren Haynes or some kind of dead like reunion of people. So, but this one, this is an interesting festival, Brian. Who's playing this that we can see?
So we got Dave and Tim headlining, Stevie Nicks, Brandi Carlile, The National, and Father John Misty.
And there's more. I mean, I think there's Black Pumas.
Yeah.
Ziggy Marley, The Spin Doctors.
It doesn't totally make sense, but it also does. And it kind of like, the more I think about it, I kind of would rather go to a festival like this than like a Bonnaroo or Coachella. Like the variety aspect where you're essentially saying, let's just throw music on shuffle. And if you are in your mid to late 30s, early 40s, and you just want a weekend away to kind of like hang out and go see some music and have some beers in the sunshine, why not? And Connecticut, by all accounts, is really gorgeous in September. So like listening to Dave play One Sweet World and then jumping over and maybe Stevie Nicks plays Dreams. You jump over and The National, you know, Matt's got like a glass of white wine that he's throwing into the crowd while he's singing Day I Die. And Father John Misty's playing his new record. And then Spin Doctors throwing out some old hits. I don't know, man. Like there's... It's weird, it's random, and it somehow fits, and it kind of feels like, isn't this what the festival should be in 2022, where it's just like, hey, the experience, it's back.
Yeah.
A festival. It doesn't matter who's playing, it's just, it's back.
Yeah, this is one of the fests that I wouldn't buy tickets in advance, but I like enough of the bands, and it's close enough to where my parents live now that... If it was going to be like a nice good weather forecast, it's like that Wednesday, I could perhaps consider it. But what's kind of interesting for me is that it's not a very big park. I saw Gathering of the Vibes there, like I said. I've been there just for recreational. It's kind of the way Gathering of the Vibes is set up. If you've ever been to Pitchfork Fest, it's almost kind of like the size of that park. Like, what's that?
It's perfect size for a festival.
Yeah, but yeah. The thing is, Dave Matthews and Tim Reynolds in Connecticut, Dave Matthews does an interesting thing to people in Connecticut. Like, I realize that he's from Charlottesville, but because of the amount of, like, prep schools and rival high schools in the late 90s, he played here a lot in, like, the mid-90s and late 90s, and I'd go see Dave Matthews, and it'd be these, like, rival high schools duke it out, like, the parking lots, like, West Side Story. It's like... People really, really fucking get up for Dave Matthews in Connecticut, which almost makes me feel like this festival, the grounds are too small to have a Dave and Tim thing. Like, for example, I went to Farm Aid at the Meadows in Hartford, Connecticut back in 2018, which is their big, like, outdoor shed where, like, Fish or Santana plays, you know. And pretty stacked dad rocking lineup, as Farm Aid tends to have. The headliners were Willie Nelson and Neil Young, John Mellencamp, and Dave Matthews and Tim Reynolds. And the lawn was incredibly, incredibly packed. I saw Dave and Tim, and despite not having followed them seriously for like maybe 18 years, I knew like every word to every song, which kind of like creeped myself out. I was like singing the non-existent saxophone parts in the song, what was it, number 41?
That's the GOAT song.
Right. And it was so crowded. And then when Dave and Tim left, despite the fact that Neil fucking Young and Willie fucking Nelson hadn't gone on yet, you could see like tumbleweeds go across the lawn. Like a whole portion of Connecticut basically treated Farm Aid as another reason to go see Dave and Tim and then leave before Neil Young came on.
That's sacrilegious. You know, I've been listening a lot to the Luther College Dave and Tim set.
Yeah.
I follow two people on Apple Music right now. If you're on Apple Music, hit me up. I would love to follow you and get your recommendations, because hey, there's a much more personable way to follow people on Apple Music versus Spotify, which I like in my first couple weeks back on that platform. But I follow Riley Walker, which is great because You get to see when Riley Walker is listening to Riley Walker, but you also get to see when Riley Walker is actually like on a deep dive of Christian rock, which happens a lot. Like he'll listen to like 3 or 4 Jars of Clay records in a row. But
what's the one he likes a lot? The third album, When I Left the Zoo.
When I Left the Zoo, I think
that's called. To him yeah. is like the peak Jars of Clay record. We've talked about this before.
But he's a huge Dave and Tim fan, and I think he's gotten a lot of inspiration. And I know, like, when I was first playing guitar, like, learning Dave Matthews songs was the first time that I was like, oh my God, your fingers can do like that, and that makes a really cool sounding chord. Like, Dave plays some of the weirdest chords ever. But he listens to a lot of Luther College, and I was like, I'm just going to throw this on. I haven't listened in a while. Man, that album rips. Every song is great. Dave sounds great. Tim Reynolds backing him up is just like, what the hell can you do with these songs? This is amazing. It's incredible. We've always, stuff. So if you haven't dug that up, please do.
I think me and my friends have said that Tim Reynolds could be the luckiest guy in show business.
I mean, he's talented as all hell. Right. But yeah, he's kind of got that Nels Klein kind of feel where like Tim could have played to small clubs in New York City for the rest of his life and just kind of made a living and played shows and like that was it.
Right.
But he was friends with
he's
Dave Matthews.
He's just a dude who happens to be friends with Dave Matthews. I mean, you're right. He yeah. is.
It's a good, right place, right time, and right talent.
Good gig. Good gig. I think he's good like gig. Part of the Dave Matthews band now too, right?
He's an official member at this point. Yeah. He tours with them fully. Yeah, they've done some overhauling of the band, but it sounds really good. I'm actually considering seeing them at Fiddler's Green this summer because I haven't seen the full Dave Matthews Band since 2001, and I don't know. I feel like it would be a killer show.
It could be fun. Yeah, it could be fun. If I didn't have anything, if a ticket fell in my lap, I would give it some consideration in my old age.
Speaking of shows coming up in 2022... we've got some immediate shows on the horizon, which I'm really excited about. And then we got some advanced shows that are coming down the pike that were just announced this past week. This upcoming weekend, at the end of this week, as you hear this show, Phish will play Mexico. Their first time playing Mexico since 2020, which, as many people recall, was the last run before the pandemic, and had an excellent Saturday night show, that 222 show. If you have not gone back and listened to it, that is a killer show that I think has been incredibly overshadowed because of the pandemic. Amazing version of Waves. We also get on Saturday, February 26th, the rescheduled Goosemiss show, which when originally announced in, I believe, summer 2021, was the first of many, not the first, but it was another in this long line of like, ooh, Goose is playing there because they're playing in, is it Uncansville, Connecticut, at the Mohegan Sun Arena?
Yeah, it's pronounced Uncasville.
Uncasville. These Uncasville. Crazy it's the Indian reservation town names. I don't know how to pronounce these names from Connecticut.
Yeah, you got the Indian reservations. It's Foxwoods and Mohegan Sun. It's the other one, right?
Got it. They're going to play there. Phish played there in 2019. It's a good, big, nice arena for them to play in. Those two shows should be really exciting. I'm stoked for what's to come. This Goose tour from the late part of January, early February was really, really good. And specifically the Redbird from Pittsburgh is one of my favorite things I've ever heard this band play. So I can't wait to see them apply that to a show that was rescheduled because of COVID.
Yeah, I'm very excited for the end of this week as well because I'm really excited to stream some Phish. I'll definitely be streaming some Goosemiss as well. Yeah, like you, I thought the latest Goose tour might have been their best to date. It certainly has the most in terms of jams I actually want to listen to more than once. Like I know last night I was lying on my couch listening to the Los Angeles show that had the great Arrow into their Kylie cover, back into Arrow, and then the first set had the really fluid Creatures and the Born to Flow Down. Just the jams are airier and more interesting, and I'm really excited to see them this summer as well.
Yeah, I can't wait to see them this summer. And if Fish Mexico should be great as well. These are our first fish shows in front of crowds since the late fall, since late October, which I'm really excited to hear how they approach this Mexico run. I think there's going to be a lot of energy coming in.
Where did I read that? This is like the first time since 1991 that fish has been playing in this many months, because you've got February, April, May, June, July, and August. It's got fish shows.
Yeah, that's true. It's only March that they're not playing in over the next 6 months. That's amazing.
Yeah.
Wow.
I don't hate it.
And September.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, yeah. Okay.
They're playing 1, 2, 3, 4 in Dick's. And they did not say these are the last shows for the year. So presumably there's a chance that if they were to do a West Coast fall leg going into Vegas with the dates of Halloween, we could see a October, November, and then December. We could get every single month of the year starting in February except for March of a fish. So who knows? That's a really interesting proposition going into 2022. In addition to that, Fish announced summer 2022 dates. Really quickly, what are you surprised by? What are you excited for, and what are you hoping to see?
I was surprised that they're playing Atlantic City, given that they're playing so many Northeast shows already. I mean, usually you wouldn't get Atlantic because they're playing Philadelphia, they're playing Jones Beach, Hartford, Bethel Woods, Great Woods, Bangor. Did they throw in a three-night run at Atlantic City on top of all those tri-state shows already? Like, I saw some rumored tour dates. I said, like, there's no way that can be right, because why would they, like I said, play three nights at AC given all the tri-state dates? But they are. No, I mean, it's a pleasant surprise. If I play my cards right, I'm going to hoping to get to probably at least between, I'd say hopefully around like between 5 and 6 shows this summer, in addition to the 4 shows I've already got lined up this April. So it could be a good year, good staff building year.
Yeah, I'm surprised that they went back to Bethel. I thought that was just off the table because, by all accounts, the folks who tend the ground at Bethel were not happy with the way that Fish left it, the Fish scene left it. By all accounts, it's an amazing venue.
I booked my Airbnb.
Nice. I talked about this last week on HF Pod. 528-2011
Great show. Is
one of my favorite shows of 3.0. And like, bar none, it's probably a top 10 3.0 show for me. It's an amazing jamming, amazing set list, super great flow. And the waves from the tech rehearsal is one of my favorite things they've ever played in 3.0. So I am really surprised that they hit that. I guess I share your surprise about Atlantic City, because it kind of seemed like maybe it's like the stand-in for a festival type of thing. Like, it's got that festival vibe to it.
Just like last year, I was on a vacation with my parents and my sister's family during those AC shows, so I got to stream them on the couch. We were in Cape Cod, so I think we're going to be in Rehoboth Beach, Delaware, at the same time this year, so I'm looking forward to streaming those on the beach or on the couch. I love being on technically vacation with my family and getting to stream Fish shows at night, because otherwise it just means watching like comedy on Netflix, and I'd rather watch Fish.
I'm hoping to hit, so I put in for Bethel and Hartford because I got family in that part of the country. I could see them. My wife could get her 100th show with her brother at Bethel, which would be pretty amazing. And then I put in for Alpine because Alpine is my favorite place to see Fish outside of my home venue now, which is Dick's. And I'm stoked for, and I cannot wait for, and I put in for all 4 nights at Dick's Sporting Goods Park, which is going to be insane. The first 4-night run at Dick's. I didn't even think it was possible. Thursday, Friday, Saturday, Sunday. I can't. I'm so giddy. The idea that we're going to add another night onto this run is just stunning. So I can't wait for that. I'm really excited.
I put in for Bethel, 1 night at Great Woods, 1 night of Man, and I'll definitely go to Hartford, but I have friends in Connecticut that claim to know people that can hook up the Hartford tickets, so I didn't want to do mail ordering, get stuck with lawn for that. There'll be there'll be plenty of options. But also,
Hartford will be easy. I seem to remember that being an easy ticket to get when I tried a couple of years ago.
Bethel Woods also holds a special place in my heart because for my father, Dr. Martin Goldstein, for his 60th birthday, my mom got him a long weekend at Rock and Roll Fantasy Camp. So he was on stage at Bethel Woods playing rhythm guitar on Santana's Black Magic Woman with the bass player from Quiet Riot, Rudy Sarzo. That was his mentor. Played bass in Quiet Riot. He was the bass player in Ozzy Osbourne's Blizzard of Oz era band. He played at Randy Rhoads. I'm told he was a very nice guy. My dad is like wearing his Jimi Hendrix t-shirt with the guitar. And so, yeah, I'll get to go back to the place where it all happened for Dr. Martin Goldstein, Bethel Woods.
That's amazing. That's great. Wow. And the one other big announcement from Goose is that they're going to play Red Rocks. They've got a one-night stand at Red Rocks this year. They're playing two nights in Dillon, Colorado, just before. I'm hoping to hit all three of those. I put in for tickets. I got them for Red Rocks. Dillon's going to be a little bit harder, but I'm hoping I can make things work. Those shows should be fantastic, and hopefully we get a little bit more from that band in terms of summer tour dates. As we do every week, before we get to the big discussion of the week, we wanted to recommend some podcasts that we have been listening to here at Osiris Media. Dave, what have you been listening to of late?
I just listened to, because it dropped 2 days ago, what I've talked about before, Wheels Off with Rhett Miller. This is not an encore interview. This is a new interview he did with Miss Margot Price. This is fun because, Margot Price talks about she's actually in the process of writing a memoir. She talks about how she was supposed to be one of the filler musicians at Dead & Co. And she was ready to go and her band was ready to go. And I think she said like 11 hours before she got on the plane, she got a notification that it was not going to happen because there were too many COVID cases. So I think Playing It in the Sand got canceled altogether, much to her dismay and the dismay of the people that were going to attend. But like all the conversations Rhett Miller does, super laid back, super interesting. Margot Price is an excellent performer, lots of good studio records, really good Twitter personality as well. So I'd say check it out.
Yeah, that's a fantastic interview and a really, really, really wild story. I'm going to recommend a podcast. I think I've recommended this before, but if not, Inside the Musician's Brain with Chris Pandolfi, who was recently a guest on Helping Friendly Podcast Live. You guys should check that out. It was a really cool conversation about Chris going to see Fish at Tahoe in 2018 and then playing a String Dusters after show right after and kind of what that experience was like. But season two of his show features an interview with Bela Fleck, which is just fascinating. Bela Fleck is the reason that Pandolfi plays banjo. So dive deep into kind of the technique behind the banjo, as well as kind of the emotional pull of playing the banjo. And, Pandolfi has just such a great way of pulling information out of his interviewees to really get inside their head and kind of inside of the process of what they're thinking as they're playing music, as they're composing music. And for me, I saw Bela Fleck and the Flecktones back in 2019 at Telluride Bluegrass Festival, and I'm still in awe of the show. It just blew my mind. So hearing him kind of talk through his approach was fascinating. So Wheels Off with Rhett Miller, the Margot Price interview, Inside the Musician's Brain with Bela Fleck. A lot more coming here in the next couple of weeks and months from Osiris Media. So keep hanging with us, but we hope that you've enjoyed some of these recommendations that we've made here. And with that, let's get to the big discussion of the week. We'll be right back. All right. So we are sitting here almost 8 weeks into 2022. A year that feels unlike any other. We're coming out of a two-year pandemic. Cases are dropping. Who knows what's on the horizon? I keep seeing news articles saying that COVID is behind us. I like to believe that that's true. My gut says that it's true. But if you had asked my gut in May 2020, I would have said that COVID would have been over by the summer, because that's what I wanted, right? You know, that's what we all wanted. I don't know what's going to happen. But the interesting thing about this year is how different it feels from this time the last 2 years. Late February 2020, we kind of knew something was on the horizon. We didn't know how bad it was going to be. We didn't know when it was really going to get bad, but we kind of knew that something was coming for us and it was going to kind of fuck up our lives. Late February 2021, we had a new president. We had hopes. Vaccines are coming. Live shows are coming back. Late February 2022, we've gone through that cycle. And now we're at this very interesting point where things are relatively back to normal. There's still that sense of risk in the air. But what is coming back in a way that maybe if you had told us in mid-2020, don't worry, this is on the horizon, we would have had a little bit more hope. And it makes a lot of sense in hindsight. What is this that I'm talking about? I am talking about a litany of incredible new music that seems to be coming out on a near daily, if not hourly, definitely weekly basis. 2022 has seen an incredible hot streak of amazing albums in just the first 8 weeks of the year, in a way that you're just simply not used to at this time of year. Usually January, February of any given normal year, you'll get one good album, you'll get someone testing the waters, you'll get a cool new discovery. But a lot of the big albums wait until April or wait until May or sometime in the summer so that they can capitalize on live performances and festivals and these songs that will really feel like they're part of summer. Sometimes an artist toils away until fall and you get that great end of the year album. You barely ever get classics in the first 2 months of the year. And this year it feels like we're getting them every single week. Dave, I'm going to pose you a question here. Based off of all this background information, why do you think that 2022 has been so strong so far?
I don't know. I think it could just be maybe a good deal of luck. Only thing I could possibly point to is that it seems like albums are coming out that have been gestating for a long time, like long records that some of the recording took place during COVID, some of it took place right before COVID. But it seems like a lot of artists that had important releases in, let's say, 2019 are kind of finally getting to put out the big follow-ups to the important 2019 releases. One thing I've noticed is just maybe a pure coincidence, but a lot of these good records have a tendency to be very long. Like, I know some of the albums we're going to talk about, Big Thief, extremely long record. I was just listening to the new record by the frontman from Ride, Andy Bell. It's like a 75-minute record. Kurt Vile announced a new album for April that's going to be almost like an hour and a half. I don't know if this is just people getting their yayas out. I don't know if this is because of the oncoming of the people getting more into listening back on CDs again. But, I mean, Christ, Beach House today dropped, what, like an 18-track record? I don't know.
Beach House dropped an 18-track record.
If that's indicative of a larger trend or just... Yeah. People, a lot of pent-up energy? Hard to say.
Yeah, it feels like it's a lot of pent-up creativity. Big Thief, you mentioned, they put out a 20-track album about a week ago. The Weeknd put out a huge record in early January. It feels to me like a lot of these records have been stewed over the last 18 months, let's say. You know, it's interesting because a lot of these artists didn't necessarily release material in like a live streaming fashion. They didn't necessarily release material throughout 2020 and 2021. they kind of put it all off towards this 2022 period. And so it probably gave a lot of artists an opportunity that they've never had before and is not really, there's no real precedent for it since rock music became the popular form of consumption, which would lead to, you know, funk and soul and music videos and hip hop and pop music and streaming and all the things that we've seen happen over the last 60, 70 years as popular music has evolved. You know, you get a lot of, you never really had this window of just everybody go away and write music and come back. And so I imagine a lot of that process was time and longevity and just sitting with ideas and letting them simmer and letting them, you know, kind of stew over. And as a result, you get a lot of these records that are really thought over and are extended and kind of move through varying moods and really showcase where these artists are at this point in their career in a way that we may not have seen if 2020 and 2021 were relatively normal years.
So what are some of the albums that have been striking your fancy that we're sitting here talking about?
So kind of just running through a list, like The Weeknd put out Dawn FM in early January. And I remember throwing that on when I was at the airport getting ready to fly to Montana and just immediately being blown away. It's such a cool record. Owen Tricks Point Never is all over that record. And it feels kind of futuristic. It feels like it's looking towards the past. That really blew me away immediately. Earl Sweatshirt put on a new record, all caps, sick. I love Earl Sweatshirt. His record from 2013, Doris, was one of my favorite records of that year. And he's just got such a way of, close friend of the pod, Brian Lee Weaver, always says he doesn't like his beats, but he loves his rhymes. And his way of phrasing words, his way of telling a story is just fascinating to me. So you get that a lot here on Sick. We've talked about it before, but Garcia People's Dodging Dues, I think it's their best record that they've put out. I think it's a record that both cements and showcases their overall sound while also kind of showcasing a new direction for the band, a little bit more emphasis in English folk. So there's a lot there that like I've really sunk my teeth into. What about you?
Certainly that Weeknd album is really good. Like you said, with the Honor Tricks Point Never production, it kind of, to me, feels like you're in like sort of like dark after hours inner city club. That was kind of like what we imagined like the year 2000 would be like in 1980.
Yeah, totally.
But also, shout out to Apple Music. That album is in Dolby Atmos sound. It sounds incredible in Apple Music on headphones. So that's really good. I have yet to listen to the Earl Sweatshirt, but I certainly like him. Yeah, I do think that Dodging Dues is the best Garcia People's album to date. And they've got a really extensive tour coming up, which I highly recommend you go see them if they come to your town. Other bands, I know in the past I've talked about the band Papier, their album Number 7, very icy, ambient, sear breath type Papier as opposed to the face shredding that they usually do. This British band called Yard Act, they're kind of post-punky, talky vocals, kind of like evokes post-punk, but kind of like the height of the Britpop era. You get kind of like a Blur, Park Life thing going on. That's a record that I've definitely enjoyed, want to go back to, listen
Hooks,
to
man.
Some more.
Hooks, yeah. Galore on that record.
A lot of hooks. And then recently, in terms of shorter records, Steve Gunn just put out the Nakama EP, which we liked a lot, that has some good remixes of stuff from Other You. And Riley Walker, who just keeps putting out music and putting out music, doesn't care. He just put out the So Certain EP, four songs that sound like they easily could have been on his last record, Course and Fable. Really excellent stuff. Very good.
Yeah, that Papier record, man, we've talked about it before, but like my dream is kind of at some point in my life, I don't know if it'll ever happen, to spend like 4 years living in Europe and living in Northern Europe. And that Papier record just sounds like taking a nice evening stroll through a European city in winter. And I'm there for it. Just give me it. It's incredible.
The dude's on Twitter too now. I think his name is Niklas Sorensen. His tweets are just photos of him holding up his favorite records and like talking about them.
It's a really good Twitter approach.
Right.
It's a really good one. I would love for Papier to figure out a way to tour America.
I think he admitted it's like not his day job. He's like he's an assistant librarian in Denmark.
Makes me love him even more.
Yeah, I know, right?
Summer of Soul soundtrack came out. The Summer of Soul documentary came out last summer, I believe last summer, early fall. Questlove helped make that.
Incredible.
Focusing on the Harlem Soul Festival in 1969. The soundtrack kicks so much ass. It's just required listening. It's got so much life. It's got so much happening under the surface musically. Hearing so many of these songs played live is just incredible. And it's one of those records that, like, because it's a compilation, it's kind of over before you know it in some cases. Like, it's a longer record. It's, I think, around an hour and a half, but like, you throw it on, it's just like, it's there. It's like you're listening to the radio in such a great way. I can't get enough of it. The much derided on this podcast, Mitski, put out Laurel Hell, her follow-up to Be the Cowboy. I've never really gotten Mitski. I've never really cared that much. There always seemed to be so much drama with what was going on with Mitski's performance and kind of her persona. I liked this record. I didn't love this record, but I liked it. And it just strikes me as just like another, you know, big record that's coming out in 2022. More recently, though, Aaron Ray put out a record called Lighten Up. Aaron Ray, I saw open up for Hiscall the Messenger.
Oh, I didn't know that.
This record rules.
Yeah.
This record rules. I listened to it twice in a row. It was one of those records that once it ended, I was like, I want to get back into that again and understand what she's trying to say. It felt like a mood the first time I listened to it. And the second time, I just started diving into the songs. And man, that record is unbelievable.
It's incredibly pleasing to the ear. It's so well produced. Like, the way the instruments are separated with her voice. I think the second song, I forget what it's called, it's a duet with Kevin Morby. There's a part on the chorus, like the banjo comes into the chorus, kind of reminds you a lot of the chorus of the Casey Musgraves song, Oh What a World, with like the with the banjo trick coming in. I mean, that's, like you said, that's a great record. The song, the third song, which I think is the single, has like the Great Spirit and the Sky beat. But yeah, really another record I really want to dive more into, just because she's a great songwriter, great voice, and I like it when things sound good, and that album certainly sounds good. Speaking of albums that sound very good, the new Spoon record, Lucifer on the Sofa. I think it's my favorite Spoon album since Ga 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 Ga. We always talk about every Spoon album is good, some are more good. I'm ready to put this one into the very good column, along with that record, along with Kill the Moonlight and Girls Can Tell, which are probably some of my more favorite Spoon albums. They don't make bad records, but this one just in particular shot out at me as something like, I can't wait to put this on, like a summer road trip album.
I really want to do a Spoon deep dive because the consistency is just immaculate, and I just kind of want to hear the evolution kind of subtle ways, but They Want My Soul is such a great Spoon record and one of my favorites. This might be their best since Ga 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 Ga, but I love They Want My Soul and Transference. I love how Transference kind of fucks around with the Spoon approach and actually works as a record. And then They Want My Soul is so tight and has, I don't know if it's my favorite Spoon song, but Inside Out, man. I mean, it helps that Goose covers that, and that they, like, that was my introduction to Goose. But Inside Out is such a great song.
Yeah, they tend to have a pattern where they'll put out the kind of the weird, fucked up demo sounding one, and then chase it with the immaculately produced one. Like, you had Ga 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 Ga, which was like the immaculately produced, well put together, like 35-minute puzzle box. Then Transference came out, and that was, I love Transference, but it's like kind of feels disconnected, feels like demos, kind of feels like some unfinished ideas. And then They Want My Soul was also just immaculate, like shining tight. Hot Thoughts, a little diffuse, a little over the place, lots of synthesizers, supposed to be like the Sexy Spoon record. Kind of, it's good, a little bit indifferent. And then back to Lucifer and the Sofa, which is the, okay, we're going to do like the classic rock, Rock Your Face, Hard as Cut, Wild, My Babe, just like Anthem Spoon, which means the next 1 in 3 years will be quiet and weird for sure.
Yeah, yeah. It'll be interesting to see where they go with it. It's they're a band that it's crazy to think sometimes that you just find a formula and you just work with that for 20 years, because a lot of bands, it's kind of what we're seeing with the War on Drugs, is that they just like, they have a formula and they just tinker with it and they make it work. And it's a really noble approach, because it takes a lot of self-control in a way that doesn't necessarily lean into artistic creativity sometimes.
Or Beach House, or The Fall, or Yola Tango, or New Pornographers. It's always the same, a little bit different, but always the same.
And always great. Yeah. When you look at the whole package, you're like, I'm just glad that they kept making great record after great record. A band that, again, has been much derided in these corners, but we are actually, I don't know if I would say smitten with, but just like kind of blown away by, is Big Thief. And the record is called 5, and you can't tell me any other way. It's Big Thief 5.
BT5.
BT5. This record, I was texting with you guys, with you and Josh. I was texting with some friends as well. At the end of the day, this band's music just never did anything for me before this. It just, I tried. People I really respect pushed them on me. They just never did anything for me. This record does things I never really considered possible with a Big Thief album. And I'm just blown away by the sonic smattering of sound and ideas that are underneath so many of these tracks that make me re-listen to it in a way that I'd never felt the desire or urge to with a previous Big Thief record.
My knock against Big Thief in the past was that I think they took themselves very seriously and never seemed to be all that much fun. I always felt like listening to their records was kind of like being lectured to.
Yes.
Add to the fact that despite being a band, a lot of the earlier records just sounded like kind of one guitar and Adrian Lenker and not much was happening. Then you'd hear a song like the song Not, with like the whole band very live. You're like, wow, why don't the other song sound like this song? Because this song is great, but nothing else on the record sounds like this. But this new one, for the first time in forever, I think it sounds like it's really fun to be in this band. It's a fun record. There's a sense of humor. They're having a good time. Like, the second song on the album, Time Escaping, sounds like they're trying to cover the Grateful Dead's Fire on the Mountain using a whole bunch of rubber bands and, like, weird cigar box guitars. I'm like, this is cool. The third song, Spud Infinity, has weird rhyming things about, she rhymes like finish with kinnish and talking about your elbows, and there's a jaw harp, and it kind of sounds like something that like Bob Dylan Rolling Thunder review would do. The song Red Moon kind of sounds like Snoopy's bluegrass band at the Daisy Hill Puppy Farm. Google that shit if you don't know. But there's trip hop, there's like a shoegaze song, like Little Things. There was a lot there, and most of it was good. And I just thinking, this doesn't even sound like the same band.
Wake Me Up to Drive is just a fascinating, very simple, but like it's incredible.
That's like the most primitive, like Casio tone drum kit. That sounds like the drum machines on like the fucking Shuggie Otis record, which was like some of the earliest, the earliest drum machines. Like, where'd they find this drum machine? Like an antique store? And then they made like a song about it.
Yeah, it's an incredible record. And it's just like a stunning reminder of how great this year has been thus far. It's, I don't know. I've said it in other places. I might have said it here. Like, I love being proven wrong about music. I love having a perception and then hearing something in a new way, or having someone explain something to me in a new way and thinking to myself, okay, like I've learned something. I've gotten something new out of this that I didn't expect. I kept trying to read that article or, hear that Big Thief song that like convinced me that, oh no, it's you. It's not them. I think for the first four records, it might've been them and not me. I just don't think that it like fully was my thing. this record is very much my thing. It's kind of an ephemeral thing to say this is great music. You kind of just know it when you know it, and this is just great music.
Yeah. Like, I've listened to the first six songs on this record pretty often, repeatedly. It's still a bit front-loaded. I mean, I would say I like the first half better than the second half. I mean, there's certainly some gems in the second half. Simulation Swarm, it's a second half song in particular. It sounds like it would have been like a great soundtrack to like a sentimental teen movie in like the late 90s. And I say that in a good way, not a bad way. But yeah, like you're saying, I think whatever, I know they said that they had to record the recorded songs in five different places. They took road trips, like whatever it was, they found a way to actually be fun and enjoyable to these ears. So that's a pleasant surprise. I have no issue liking that band, that album. I'll go back and try the other records again. I don't know if it's going to have a different result, but we'll see.
Yeah.
And then the last...
At this...
No, I was going to say one of the last records I just wanted to comment on here was Eddie Vedder from Pearl Jam. Obviously put out a solo record called Earthling with some big celebrity cameos on it. There's like an Elton John duet. They have... I think Ringo Starr plays drums in one of the songs. Stevie Wonder plays harmonica, and I think all three of the songs come in the bottom half of the record. But this is it's an interesting record in that it's incredibly produced, because I think all the Pearl Jam records, basically starting with Avocado and the three that came after it, all kind of sound the exact same, sort of like stripped down, not very much in the way of frills production. But this Eddie Vedder record has like some big 80s production. There's songs that sound just like the War on Drugs. There's a Tom Petty song. Like the first song kind of sounds like some like Peter Gabriel, so like Red Rain era type weird production on it. And I kind of listened to it, think like this kind of reminds you of Trey Anastasio's Shine. And I looked at the cover record, and I see that Eddie Vedder's like, he's holding the guitar in one hand, and Trey and Shine's hoisting the guitar. I'm like, oh, all right, so Eddie's gotten to his, like, hoist my guitar on the cover of the album phase. I think it's a better record. I think it's a better record than Shine, but it's kind of that, like, produced, super dad rocky, kind of fascinating sound to it.
I need to put this record on again. I listened to it once, and I got that vibe from it, and I was like, I don't know if I need to hear this again, but... I may be in the vibe for that at this point in
time. Yeah, I'm going to hear it at least once or twice more. But yeah, it's not. I'm not going to listen to it to the exclusion of Ten or Vitalogy anytime soon.
So at this point in the year, what would you say are your top five records of 2022?
Unranked, Garcia People's Dodge and Dues, Papier 7, Big D 5. Spoon, Lucifer on the Sofa, and Kate LeBond, Pompeii, which I raved about last week on the drop, and I still love it just as much as I did last week. That's my five. If I had to pick a six, it's probably the Animal Collective record.
Yeah, mine are Animal Collective, Time Skiffs, a record we did not mention because we had talked about it in past episodes, but another record that when that came out, and Animal Collective had put out a great record in the 2020s, I kind of spit out my drink and was like, are you kidding me? They got best new music and the record is amazing. Big Thief 5, Jake Xerxes' Fusils record. Good and Green Again, which I have been absolutely loving of late. The Weeknd, Dawn FM, as I mentioned up top. I mean, just an incredible... Dave said it perfectly. It sounds like a 1980s record about the year 2000. I love that.
Or, you know, there's like in the 90s, they always had that movie where the hero goes to like the weird cyberpunk dance and... people have goggles on their heads and there's all these strobes. Maybe it's like soundtracked by like some Nine Inch Nails knockoff. Kind of reminds me of that, but good.
Yeah, it's that scene in The Matrix where they're playing Rob Zombie.
Yeah, exactly.
And then Bonnie Prince Billy and Bill Callahan's duet Blind Date Party, which is a assortment of cover songs, It was released in late December 2021, but I'm counting it as a 2022 album. It's a bunch of cover songs of some of their label mates, but you get Yusuf Islam, Hank Williams Jr., Billie Eilish, Smog cover, which was Bill Callahan's previous project, Lou Reed cover, Steely Dan cover, Jerry Jeff Walker, Little Feat, Iggy Pop, Leonard Cohen, Palace Music, Silver Jews cover that has Cassie Berman on it, which is just amazing. And it ends with a John Prine cover of She Is My Everything. It's 19 tracks. It is 90 minutes and 0 seconds. It is 90 minutes on the dot. And it's amazing. You go back and forth between Callahan and Bonnie Prince Billy. It's some of my favorite stuff from this year thus far.
Yeah, another example of a really long record in 2022.
There it is. There it is. Well, we hope you guys have enjoyed our kind of wrap up here of early 2022. We just kind of wanted to dedicate this segment to giving you a deep dive into our thoughts on the year, some of the records that we have, for a variety of reasons, just not had time to mention because there's so much to cover thus far in 2022. This was fun. We should do a check-in in a couple of months just to see where the year is at. So as we have been doing, we are marching backwards in time, and we have reached 1987, which I go back and I remember when we started podcasting in 2017, and we looked back at what was then 30 years ago, 1987. And the idea to me that 5 years from then was going to be 30 years to 1992 kind of blew my mind away. Like 1987 felt like it was 30 years ago. Now, of course, 5 years later, 1992 feels like it was 30 years ago, but it still just kind of blows my mind. 1987 feels rightly in the past, but also a slight part of the present. And we wanted to feature a couple songs, a couple albums from 1987 that really hit us and linger with us in the years since and kind of speak to our vibe about 1987. And no, I did not select Neil Young and Crazy Horse's Life. Although I thought about it because it's such a great 87 record. Dave, before we get into the albums here, what does 1987 mean to you? What was it in your mind and in your memories?
1987 was the first year I ever went to Walt Disney World. So that looms quite large. I was turning 8 years old in September. We went to Disney World. I had my autograph book. I got all my autographs of the big Disney World characters walking around. Remember, we first went to the park at night. I walked to the turnstile. The guy turned to me and said, "You know something, kid? You won." "What did I win?" "We got free passes to the Disney Park Discovery Island." And I didn't win anything ever after walking through the turnstile at Disney World, and that hurt me deeply. But I did win that one time.
You haven't even won a World Series since then.
No. Also, 87, I bet I watched the Mets a lot in 87. I think I have the entire Mets roster in Topps and Fleer and Donruss baseball cards from 1987. It's not worth a goddamn thing. I definitely looked that up. I think I was in third grade with Mrs. Buntadibus at Norton School in Cheshire, Connecticut. I don't know. But what was I listening to in 87? I didn't really start listening to music in a Walkman until Weird Al Yankovic's Even Worse came out next year. But I'm going to pick out a record that meant a whole lot to me in high school. It still does. And and that is Rush's Hold Your Fire, which came out, I want to say, October or November of 1987. The first single was Time Stand Still. We could listen to a little bit of that song. A lot of classic rock bands in the 80s, they went towards the synthesizers that were cropping up everywhere. The Yamaha DX7, they needed to know all the information about synthesizers, these big, brilliant electronic machines, and Rush was no different in that respect. They went very hard on the synthesizers. I think probably starting, their records are kind of grouped together in threes. So starting with 1984's Grace Under Pressure, then 85's Power Windows, and then 87's Hold Your Fire. A whole lot of synthesizers. Of those three albums, this one is probably my favorite because it has some very pretty vocal melodies. There's definitely more than a little bit of cheese. This is when they were kind of wearing their big white, like Miami Vice, Don Johnson type blazers on stage. The lead singer, bass player, Geddy Lee, kind of had like a bouffant and a ponytail, which made him look a bit like Robespierre. But this was just a kind of very pretty, synthy, very of its time Rush album. But it definitely has a lot of songs that they kind of like kept in their set list going forward. Like the song Time Stand Still is a set list staple. The seventh song on the album called Mission, excellent song, kind of one of those like deep cuts that, in the words of my friend Jeremy Holiday, who's a big Rush fan, says Mission is one of those songs that the crazy Rush internet weirdos want to hear. So that's they still play that song. It also has the second to last song called Taishan, which was a poem about the drummer Neil Peart's visit to China, which is the one song that when people interview Rush and they say, is there any song you don't like? They kind of look at the ground and say, yeah, Taishan kind of didn't turn out the way we wanted it to. That's their stock answer. So it's a record. I mean, I discovered every boy who gets in the Rush, you got to discover them when you're 12, 13, or 14. No one discovers them at 15 or 11. It's always 12, 13, or 14. I really discovered them when I was 14 on my 8th grade trip to Washington, D.C. when I bought the Roll the Bones record at Union Station in D.C. And it was just a love affair that has continued hardcore till this day. Love Hold Your Fire. Love the 80s synth sound. The melodic guitar. The cool jackhammer sounds that open up the album at Force 10. But we're going to listen to some of Time Stand Still. Here it comes right now.
To my back to the wind, to catch my breath before I start off again. Living on without a moment to spend, to pass an evening with a drink and a friend. I let my skin get too thin. I'd like to pause no matter what I pretend. Like some pilgrim who loves the tramps and learns to live as
all right. So 1987, I was 2 years old. So as much as I'd love to have memories of 1987, the only like real memories I have, not memories, like just like understanding that I have of that year was I listened to the Joshua Tree a lot. And my brother was like 3 or 4 months old when 1987 started. So the whole year was me adjusting to not being an only child. I never got to even savor being an only child. How fucked up is that? I was 18 months old when my brother was born. I never even knew what life was like as an only child.
It's not how it's cracked up to be.
Fair, but you know, I just, I wish I'd had that perspective.
By which I mean, I was an only child for 3 years. I love my sister very much.
That's a fair point. I was going to pick a record from 1987 that I'm just going to mention here because it was my first favorite song. John Cougar Mellencamp's The Lonesome Jubilee has the single Cherry Bomb on it that came out in October 1987, and there are videos of me dancing to the music video, and I have like vivid memories of whenever that song would come on at my parents' house.
You're lip-syncing That's When a Smoke Was a Smoke?
It was. I don't know.
Groovy, you know, was groovy.
What it was. I don't know what it was about that song that really connected with me, but at 2-3 years old, apparently it did. The record I'm going to talk about is a record from one of my favorite singer-songwriters, Mr. Warren Zevon. The record is titled Sentimental Hygiene. It's his sixth album. It was his first album in 5 years. It featured a really big single from him, Reconsider Me, which is one of my favorite Warren Zevon songs. It also features Peter Buck, Mike Mills, and Bill Berry of REM on various tracks on the record, including all three on the song that we are going to feature here. It also features Bob Dylan playing harmonica on The Factory and Neil Young playing lead guitar on the title track. It's an awesome record. It is a great 37-minute long album that if you want to just figure out, do I like Warren Zevon or not? This is an excellent way to step into that world and learn a bit more about him. Boom Boom Mancini is one of his best historical sports type of tracks. Reconsider Me, as I mentioned, is gorgeous. Detox Mansion really kind of showcases his battles with sobriety. And the album closes with the synth heavy. Speaking of synths, this is it. 1987. Everything had synths and they fucking ruled, man. They absolutely ruled. Leave My Monkey Alone, which was apparently a dance crossover hit for Warren Zevon, which, okay. But we're going to play a little bit of Even a Dog Can Shake Hands, which, like I said, features members of REM on it and is a great, great introduction to the man, Mr. Warren Zevon.
Survive up on Mulholland Drive. He's got the phone in the car in his hand. Everybody's trying to be a friend of mine. Even the dog can shake hands. He bombs 20% because he knew you back when. Now they all bought a piece of the band. Everybody's trying to be a friend of mine. Even a dog can shake hands. All the worms and the gnomes are having lunch at Le Dome. They're all living off the fat of the land. Everybody's trying to be a friend of mine. Even a dog can shake hands.
Big, long episode here. Thank you all for listening. We wanted to give you a full deep dive into our lives as well as what was going on in 2022 music, as well as peek back in time at 1987. We're going to take a week off next week. Dave is taking a trip, and we want to, you know, just sit back and enjoy Fish Mexico, and then we'll be back in the first week of March with a bit more drop for you all. So hope you guys have a wonderful long weekend. Enjoy the NBA All-Star Game, or I hope you enjoyed it. And I hope that you enjoy Fish Mexico as well as Goosemas this upcoming weekend. It should be great.
Enjoy Fish Mexico. Enjoy Goosemas. Enjoy hanging out with your kids. If this week is for your February midwinter break for elementary schools like it is for me and my kids, yeah. Then come back. Like Brian said, we're going to take that week off. We'll be back at the beginning of March with another episode of The Drop. We'll be right back.
service.
Hey everyone, this is Tuck from Fit for a King in Off-Road Minivan. Every week I bring you fun interviews alongside your favorite metalcore entertainers with my new podcast, Get Tucked. Join me every Monday with bands like Counterparts, Crystal Lake, like Moths to Flames, and many more. We play unsigned and undiscovered bands, deep dive into each artist's history, and of course provide the greatest breakdowns in current metalcore. Tune in to Get Tucked every Monday, out now through Sound Talent Media.
Welcome to us talking about our podcast for a minute.
What's the name of that podcast?
That's Axe to Grind. And right now you're going to be getting a little taste of it, right down to the shaky microphone and all.
And my name's Bob.
And my name's Patrick. And usually we're joined by Tom.
Tom's the best. Tom has a real grown-up job that requires him to be at work. But we talk about decidedly not so grown-up things like
hardcore music and things that people that like hardcore music tend to like.
So that could be the latest shows, revisiting classic material, talking about the new classics, all the little dorm room nonsense that you imagine from niche music podcasts that you either love, want to love, or hate.
Yeah, imagine all the emotions that you have towards a genre that has impacted your life, and then condense them down to an hour to 2 hours a week.
So triangulate your speakers. Think about jumping off the bed, singing along, dancing like an idiot, and listen to Axe to Grind podcast.